Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Marion Cotillard and Michael Fassbender star in Macbeth, a thrilling new adaptation of Shakespeare's tragedy about betrayal, war, and madness. It's now available on demand. Also playing on demand is Barney Thompson, the story of a socially awkward barber who leaves his uninteresting life behind as he enters into the grotesque world of the serial killer.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Lord Matthew Singer, who, with the assistance of my loyal woman servant, Allison, intend to devote this episode of Film Spotting SVU to a discussion of the comedic effort Mordecai, starring John Christopher Depp II.
I will end you.
Quite.
With some grave misgivings about how many accents this will give Matt an excuse to do, and apologies in advance to the city of Boston, we will also be taking a look at the career of Johnny Depp, who's gone from 21
Johnny.
Jump...
It's pronounced Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp. I can't do this. Who's gone from 21 Jump Street Heartthrob to Quirky Leading Man to whatever it is he's up to in this latest stage. And as always, we'll be offering up recs of some of his films available to rent or stream at home right now. But first up is Opening Break, the segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we highlight some notable films that are new on demand. Matt, it's your turn. What have you got for us?
I've got some words for you, Wilmore, for making fun of my Johnny.
I'm so sorry, Boston.
How dare you?
Sorry
How
to everyone.
How dare you?
Sorry to the world.
Yeah, you should be.
Well, I've got a couple of interesting movies here, one of which I haven't seen, but the first one I have, a movie I haven't heard a lot about. I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival. It sort of got buried by, admittedly, more interesting and exciting movies, but it's one of those films that, you know, it's not exceptional, but I found very solid, very much worth your time. I'm not sure if Allison's seen it. It's called The Program. It's directed by Stephen Frears, and it'll be available on VOD on March 18th. This is a biopic about Lance Armstrong, a character, a human being, I find utterly fascinating. He's played in the movie by Ben Foster, and the movie also stars Chris O'Dowd, who's another actor I like a lot. He plays the reporter who pursues the story that Armstrong may, in fact, I don't want to spoil anything here, but he may be in fact doping in order to win the Tour de France.
Inside each and every one of us is something more potent, more powerful than any drug. It's called the will to survive.
What does it take for you to race?
I just love to ride my bike.
No longer confined to Earth, now we had learned to fly.
He's a man transformed. He's recovered from cancer. I'm turned into bloody Superman.
Why are you so obsessed with this?
Why are you not obsessed with this?
Now, as I said, it's a pretty conventional movie. This is not a, like, radical reinvention of the movie biography. And, you know, there's a lot of biopics at a festival like Toronto because, you know, it's the fall movie season in Toronto. They're positioning Oscar movies. So there's a lot of films like this. And I felt like this one, you know, it just kind of got lost in the shuffle. But it's a pretty decent version of what's admittedly a pretty familiar movie. And I think that's mostly the reason to see it is Ben Foster, who does a really good job playing Lance Armstrong. I think he's very convincing, bringing out the different facets of this guy, you know, that was charming, you know, like a rock star sports figure, but who was also behind the scenes so insanely competitive. He would destroy people basically without a second thought, all to protect his big secret, which I will not spoil again, but whatever it was. And it's directed by Stephen Frears, who's made a lot of very good movies like The Grifters and High Fidelity, Dirty Pretty Things, The Queen. it's not amongst his top tier films. Again, I'm not saying this is a masterpiece, but again, we're talking about something you're going to watch at home. I think it would look pretty good on the small screen. It's a good movie. I thought I enjoyed it. I didn't hear a lot of people talking about it. I don't even know that many people who saw it. I think it was programmed against other bigger movies, and for some reason I wound up at this instead of that. And I liked it, and I think people who see it are going to be impressed, at the very least, with Ben Foster, who gives a really good performance. So that's The Program, and that is available on VOD on March 18th. Next up, a movie I haven't seen but heard a lot of good things about, and I'm looking forward to finally catching up with. It's available on VOD on March 22nd. It's called James White. It's directed by Josh Mond, and I'll read you the plot description here. James, a 20-something New Yorker, struggles to take control of his self-destructive behavior in the face of momentous family challenges, and this movie got great reviews. It got some awards nominations, like at the Spirit Awards, and I heard nothing but great things about the stars, Christopher Abbott and particularly Cynthia Nixon. So did you see this one?
I did see it, and I think it's well worth checking out.
Yeah.
In particular for Christopher Abbott, who I think really just surprises you with being like very different physically from his character on Girls, very... and just like a different type of character. And it really digs into basically a bro who has to learn to find these depths within himself.
I can definitely relate, because if there's one thing I am, it's a bro who needs to find the depths within.
There you go.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to checking that one out. That's James White, available on VOD on March 22nd. And finally, you heard it already mentioned on the show, it is the new version of Macbeth, directed by Justin Kurzel. It's available now on VOD. You got Michael Fassbender. You've got Marion Cotillard. You have Macbeth, which I'm told here is apparently a play by someone named William Shakespeare?
I've heard of the guy.
Okay. I'm unfamiliar, but I'm sure, you know, with a name like that, I'm sure he's probably done some good stuff. Justin Kurzel, of course, directed the Snowtown Murders. He's now working, actually with the exact same cast, Fassbender and Cotillard, I believe, are both in the Assassin's Creed movie based on the video game series, which is both really fun and completely laughable. I'm guessing you've never played it, Allison.
I have not. I have read about it, though, so I have a pretty good sense of what
I mean,
it's like.
I don't know how faithful they're going to be to the full scope of the
series. There's
going to
be a lot of wearing of historical hoodies.
Historical
right?
hoodies yeah. are a big part of it, but like, there's like this whole contemporary part that I don't know that you're if you're aware of. I don't know if they're going to put in the movie either, but makes the games completely silly. where there's not only like these like, you know, you've seen like the character, like very like sort of medieval assassins and stuff like that, which are super cool, but there's this sci-fi modern component that is very laughable.
Awesome.
I have no idea if that's going to be in there. But anyway, Macbeth, there's no sci-fi component. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. Just absolutely gorgeous. I hope it translates well at home. I mean, it was a great movie to watch on the big screen, and Fassbender and Cotillard, I thought, were both really good in that film. So that's Macbeth, and that's available now on VOD.
I am Mordecai, Lord of Silverdale. I should like to request a bucket of ice, do not disturb sign, and a bulldozer.
Checking in?
Yeah, we're checking in.
I suspect that I may need to redecorate.
Room 326 overlooks the pool.
So all I must do is show up, and I'm presented with a credit card. No wonder your country's in financial ruin.
Do you need help with your bags?
No, I do not need help with my bags. I have a bloody manservant.
On every episode of Film Spotting SVU, we turn the duty of selecting our main review over to you guys, our listeners, asking you to vote on one of three options. And this time your choices were the original Ghostbusters, which is available on Amazon Prime, the foreign language film Oscar nominee Thebe, which is available for rent, and 2015's big flop Mordecai, which is available on Hulu and Amazon Prime. And to our, let's go with surprise, I think we were both expected Ghostbusters to win.
Yeah.
It was Mordecai that walked away with the victory.
It stole it, you might say.
Oh, God. Mordecai is based on the first of a series of novels by Kirill Bonfiglioli. I hope I pronounced that remotely right. Who was an art dealer himself, like the character. The character of Lord Charlie Mordecai and his manservant Jock Strap, who are played in the movie by, respectively, Johnny Depp and Paul Bettany, are sort of a sociopathic riff on P.G. Wodehouse's Jeeves and Wooster, which were books all about the adventures of a foppish aristocrat and his almost supernaturally competent valet. And Lord Charlie Mordecai is, as I said, a dart dealer and an unscrupulous one who is married to Joanna, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, who is established to be infinitely smarter and more together than he is. Then he's got his loyal, sexually irresistible manservant, Jock, who sticks with him despite a running joke about how often Mordecai ends up shooting him. Mordecai was directed by David Kopp, who is better known as a writer of things like Jurassic Park and Spider-Man, and involves the Mordecais being in a very high-end sort of debt and getting pulled into an international caper to find a stolen Goya painting as an attempt to fix that problem. Ewan McGregor also stars in the movie as a police inspector who's been in love with Joanna since college and is holding out hopes that her marriage will fall apart. And for a while, it seems like it might because of Mordecai's mustache.
Oh, does he have a mustache in this movie?
He might have a mustache.
I didn't even notice.
There's a Hong Kong gang, a nymphomaniac heiress, and some Nazi gold. But mostly the plot is an excuse for bits of stylized screwball comedy and slapstick. This film was one of last year's most notorious flops, both critically and commercially. And I will say up front that I am not going to be making the case that this one is a misunderstood future classic. But I did want to ask you, Matt.
Yes.
When you were watching this film, did you have the sense of the tone it was aiming for, even if it didn't necessarily reach it? Or was it just confounding?
Well, can I answer yes to both? I mean, I think I do know that. I mean, it's trying to be a very silly movie, but it is also a confounding movie at the same time. And somehow this is the second time I've seen this movie. I have inexplicably seen Mordecai twice. And watching it the second time, while I didn't like it the first time, I feel like no one should ever watch this movie twice. And I did not enjoy seeing it a second time. But I do feel like a lot of the issue is my Johnny. He is terrible in this movie. And I really feel like if you put an actor in his role who's not quite so over the top, you might have something. Or if you replace him and also turn everyone down just a little bit. You know, like I was watching it again this time, I was thinking of, if you look online, you can find the Zucker's and Abrams like rules of comedy. Zucker's and Abrams, of course, made Airplane and The Naked Gun. And their number one rule of comedy is never make a joke on a joke, right? And that the idea being that if you make two jokes at the same time, it doesn't make it twice as funny. The jokes cancel each other out. So I'm reading this now from their rules. When an actor delivers a punchline, it should be done seriously. It dilutes the comedy to try to be funny on top of it. Likewise, if there is something silly going on in the background, the foreground action must be free of jokes and vice versa. So this movie violates this rule at every moment of its existence. There are funny accents. There's funny hair. There's funny mustaches. There's funny facial expressions. There's funny costumes. There's funny names with characters named like Krampf. And every time Johnny Depp says Krampf, he stretches it out to eight syllables. And it just feels like everyone is trying so hard to be funny. And that it occasionally is funny for a chuckle here or there. But that, like you said, the tone, whatever they were aiming for, which seems to be like that sort of fun, jaunty, sprightly heist movie sort of vibe, almost like a broader Ocean's 11, they just miss it completely.
Yeah, I kept thinking of all things, the Kroll Show joke, the sketch, Too Much Tuna. Do you know it?
I don't.
So Nick Kroll and John Mulaney, these are characters that they've had before this. And in the sketch, which happens a few times throughout the Kroll Show, they play these older Upper West Siders named Gil Faison and George St. Geeglin.
Okay.
And they have a local TV show in which they have a guest at a diner and they pretend it's like for an interview. And then when the guest's meal arrives, it's like a giant mound of tuna in a sandwich, and it's too much tuna. And it's an incredibly lame joke that they inevitably ruin because they're so pleased with the joke that they can't help but basically explain it before it even happens.
Right.
And this movie, I feel like it just does that again and again.
It's a giant pile of tuna.
It is a giant pile of tuna. I mean, like, for instance, there's a whole bit in which Ewan McGregor's character is almost tricked into eating overripe cheese.
Yes.
And it goes on for a long time.
Yes.
And, like, the whole idea of someone eating overripe cheese is already, like, not a very good joke.
No.
And the whole bit is based around him, like, is he going to eat it? Is he
right,
not?
And he keeps getting it close to his mouth.
Right, and
Mordecai, who has set this up, I guess, to poison this guy, because he doesn't like him.
Right.
Is like, and then he'll move the cheese away from his mouth, and it's like, oh, drat.
And then, or the bit in which... The mustache, which he grows a mustache, and every time his wife hates it, refuses to sleep with him.
Right.
When she kisses him, she gags.
Right. Joke. And he has a sympathetic gag reflex, so when she gags, he gags.
Right.
I have to confess, I might have laughed at that once or twice. The sympathetic gag reflex thing just cracked me up.
Okay.
I'll be honest.
Okay. Fair,
I'll be honest.
Fair. You got it.
The
you know?
Cheese is beyond help.
Sure. But or even like there's the bit in which Mordecai is caught by his wife in like a compromising position on the dance floor with Olivia Munn.
Right.
Something that is also like just telegraphed from like so far away.
Sure, and we've seen this in
and
a million movies.
And it's just set up and you're like, it feels almost like it's supposed to be anti-comedy because it's so thudding when it happens that you're like, wait, is there another joke? Is like the joke that this is so stale that... But then there's never
an additional level. That's funny you mentioned that. I had that thought too. Like, what am I missing here? Like the cheese scene that you mentioned, I almost sent me into a spiral of existential despair because it makes so little sense as a joke. Like if you're paying attention, okay, they set this up by like Johnny Depp, Mordecai has the Ewan McGregor character over. Or he shows up. Ewan McGregor is recruiting Mordecai against his will to work on this case, as you mentioned. And Mordecai's like, well, I'm going to stick it to him by making him eat this stupid verstunken of cheese.
Yeah, but before then, he like basically tricks Ewan McGregor into choosing his like crummy wine.
Right, his port.
Yeah, port, excuse me. Which Ewan McGregor is not cultured enough to know that it is crummy.
Yeah,
and he's
hilarious.
Like, I got you.
Yeah, hilarious. Yeah. And then he's like, bring the special cheese or something. And when Jock brings it out, it's so like toxic smelling that he has to like, you know, he has to hold his breath. He has to put on
gloves.
They
have a whole cupboard full of
overripe
cheese. Yeah,
which
also.
Is sort of, again, that's mildly amusing. But that, okay, so the idea is that this cheese is so toxic, it can't be touched or smelled. So how could anyone, unless they had established, which they don't, that Ewan McGregor is hard of smelling, like how does that joke work at all?
Or that, I don't know, that he's so uncultured he can't tell that cheese has the most disgusting
odor ever?
I don't know.
It makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And
I just want to say, can I say one more thing?
Please.
Ewan McGregor should send Johnny Depp a bouquet, like an edible arrangement, I don't know what, every Christmas to thank him for being even worse than he is in this movie because he is so horrible too, but no one noticed because Johnny Depp is on another level of bad.
Right.
And I thought Hugh McGregor is so horrible in this movie.
He is bad. Well, he just has, I mean, I don't, this movie has very little comic timing in general, but he is not, he's barely present, I feel like. Every scene he has is very like... It's almost like it was just a run through they did before, and he didn't know the camera was rolling. You know, I think it's actually Gwyneth Paltrow who I think gets the closest to what I would imagine this movie was aiming for.
Yes, I would agree.
You know, I think that she has a better sense of this kind of like very cutting like bits of dialogue or supposed to be cutting bits of dialogue. You know,
yeah.
That, like these very like you know jousty exchanges that they have.
The issue is she has no chemistry with Johnny Depp.
No.
You know, she's so great, like with Robert Downey Jr., where you go, I love watching them in those Iron Man movies where it doesn't even matter what they're saying. Just the two of them sparring, you just, the sparks are flying.
Yeah.
And even if the characters are supposed to be kind of in a fight in this movie, you don't even feel that. It's just, they're talking at each other and it's like they're not even in the same world.
Exactly. Because also she is playing like a slightly heightened version of this kind of modern aristocrat and he is playing a cartoon.
He is.
And their relationship makes no sense because you don't understand why anyone would marry him because I think this is another problem with them like maybe not understanding the source material or not knowing how to adapt it, which is that it's stylized but it's also set in the present day,
yeah,
and there's a lot of bits of humor that it like I you know there's this whole part in which Mordecai gets sent to the US, which he calls the colonies,
yes, the west colonies,
or something, and he acts like It's totally alien territory,
yes.
Right?
He goes to the Standard in Los Angeles, and he says he's like, he thinks he's wandered into a porn movie.
Right, because there are women in bikinis.
Right.
And then he's handed a key card.
Yeah.
And he's like, did you just give me a credit card? Like, no wonder your economy has like melted down, which doesn't make any sense as a joke.
Right.
Nor does it make any sense unless he like was like Rip Van Winkle and has like woken up. Like, it makes, like, the books are written in the 70s, you know, and very little, there's a way in which he's, and the character is supposed to be out of date then, I would assume, and kind of like out of touch.
You would think so, given his behavior.
It seem like he really, I don't know, has like never left like the estate in which he grew up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very weird.
It's a mystifying movie in a lot of ways.
It's very mystifying.
Occasionally, I think there are a few bits that are mildly funny. And it's a good-looking movie, like the production design, the costuming. I like even, you know, the way that, because it is sort of a globe-trotting movie in a certain sense, because they're bouncing around the world looking for art and escaping the police and this, that, and the other. And I like even the transitions that they do with these cool, like, you know, planes flying around the world, and they tell you where they are with these big letters that kind of appear over whatever city they're in. That sort of works, and like the music, like it has this jaunty kind of vibe that you feel like in a better movie with a better calibrated performances, I think could have worked really well.
I agree. I mean, I can see even like a movie that is really kind of leaning into the idea of people who are like a holdover, whose lifestyles are a holdover from like, you know, like several generations ago at this point,
right.
You know, but people who like have never like had jobs and have never, you know, like even the idea of doing something that is not basically a hobby,
right.
You know, is foreign to them, that you can be £8 million in debt to the government,
right.
And also still live in this like giant estate and live a pretty like high life, you know. I mean, I think there's something really funny about that like there's like a lot of room for comedy there, mm-hmm. for someone who really can like get it right. This movie comes nowhere near getting it right.
Yeah, I keep trying to think of like how it could work, and I keep coming back to the idea that it's just everything is a joke on a joke. Like, I was trying to think, like, who in this movie uses their normal speaking voice? And the answer is almost no one. A few of the minor characters,
right.
Olivia Munn and Jeff Goldblum, who's another person. He has a small role, but I felt like Jeff Goldblum actually got this movie too. Like, he actually plays it straight, whereas everyone else is big and broad. And it's like they assembled the wacky accent Avengers. It's like, let's put together all of the wackiest accents in the entire universe and stick them all in a movie together and have them all, you know, just talk around each other.
Yeah. Well, see, it's funny. You called out like the kind of production value of this, but I think there's like a touch of like Wes Anderson-y-ness to like, I don't even want to say it's not the tone, but like a little bit of to the design of it. It's much more kind of slick than that, and much kind of more cartoony. But
yes,
it's a part of the problem for me, I think, is that like these characters needed to be brought down to earth a bit more, not to be so stylized.
Right. And I feel like you could either do Depp or his character. Mordecai is the straight man and everyone around him is wacky, or he's crazy and everyone around him is sort of bemused, befuddled, confused by him. Like, instead, everyone is silly and weird and wacky to varying degrees, and it's just, there's no base level of reality. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Johnny Depp is a cartoon in this movie. I mean, and I would imagine that's what he was going for. I mean, that's what he goes for in a lot of his movies, which I'm sure we'll talk about in our next segment. It's just, I don't understand it. Just, but it's like you go, well, how could this have worked with this performance?
Not with this performance. I don't think that this performance can fit in this type of, like, I don't know where it would fit ever. Like, you know, I know that this is, he wants to go big now. Like, everything he does is going so big, but he just tears through this movie. Like, maybe if there was someone totally different in this, I don't know that it would be a successful movie, but it wouldn't be so bewildering.
Yeah.
Where you're like, I don't understand what this is even trying to do.
Besides the mustache and all the jokes in the mustache, I felt like the most emblematic choice was, you know, there's actually several like chases in this movie. It's sort of almost an action movie. And there's one chase where instead of it just being a chase, cars chasing one another, there's a motorcycle. But it's not just a motorcycle. It's a motorcycle with a sidecar, because that's like funny, right? Sidecars are funny. It can't just be a motorcycle chase. It's got to be a quirky, funny motorcycle chase. And like, to me, that's this movie in a nutshell. It's a sidecar motorcycle chase, right? Everything has to be wacky and silly and goofy and quirky. It can't just be what it is.
Yeah, I agree. And it's got this very like roundabout storyline that, you know, the point is not there to make any sense, but I wish that
I could see it being the, it's funny, I could, like, I'm looking, watching it and going, I could see this being the premise of a more serious heist movie and being totally fine. Like, this could totally be the plot of a perfectly serviceable heist movie. The funny thing to me was that the plot is resolved and then the movie continues for like 20 more minutes on the insane assumption that we love these characters so much that we don't want to leave the theater. We don't want the movie to end. We just want to spend more time with Mordecai and his wife and Jock.
Well, that's the problem, right? Is that the movie presents itself as being about this caper, but actually the stakes in the movie are, will the Mordecais be able to continue living in the style to which they are accustomed?
Right. And like, also, will their marriage survive?
Right. Like, will he preserve the status quo?
Yes.
Of like having a Rolls Royce,
having a manservant,
having a
ridiculous mansion,
and basically selling art,
keeping his mustache.
Yes, exactly. And spoilers, like, yes, he all
the
of
status quo is maintained, and there's nothing more exciting in a movie than
that. But that's why it keeps going, and when it does, you're like, wait.
No, this is over. I'm done. I'm done with this movie.
But also, like, why would you think I cared about whether or not he could continue to live this life, this weird life that you have not set up very well?
It's a movie that is so bizarre that it's not boring.
It isn't, and it's very much itself.
Yes,
you know, it's a disaster, but it's a
singular disaster.
Yeah, and it's also very consistent. You know, whatever it was they were trying for,
they achieved
it,
for better or worse.
It's like throughout. It doesn't feel like one of those movies where you're like, oh, this was chopped to bits.
No.
And one scene is like wildly different from another.
Right. Or there's big chunks missing. Yes. Like the studio cut it to shreds to try to make something more
consistent
mainstream.
All the way through.
Absolutely. It is what it is.
Well, that is Mordecai. Try it if you dare.
Try it, colonists, and enjoy. I love the way he can make a word with three syllables into a 50-syllable word. He can't be quiet.
You're getting like a little into Austin Powers with well, you can find it on Hulu and Amazon Prime.
In a merry mood today, Mr. Todd.
Tis your delights are catching fire from one man to the next.
Tis true, our love can still inspire the blood to pound the heartly pyre. What more
can man require
than love, sir?
More than love, sir.
What's that?
Women.
Ah, yes, women.
Pretty women.
Well, let's continue our discussion of Johnny Depp, the man, the myth, the legend, the series of ridiculous accents and hairs. I mean, that's really what he's become.
I know. It wasn't always that way, though.
No.
I feel like, I mean, this is a very obvious read on Depp's career, but I think that his starting off as the heartthrob in 21 Jump Street and being this kind of alt leading man for a while, it, like, so much of his more recent career seems to be pushing back against that, or just like boredom, to be like, I don't want to be a normal leading man anymore. All I want to do is go big, gnaw on the scenery, wear some kind of crazy makeup and outfit. I feel like most of his recent roles,
almost all.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the last time we're looking at his IMDb page? What was the last time Johnny Depp played someone without a funny voice and or funny hair?
Transcendence,
where he literally played a computer.
Right.
A man who became a robot,
right.
A computer.
He was barely like alive as a person.
Right.
In
and
that
so
movie.
There it was like, and there was like a sort of digital component to that performance.
Right.
Okay. And before that?
Lucky them, I didn't see.
I don't even know what that is.
I don't know what that is. And before that, the Rum Diary?
No, I mean, there he was doing the
that's true.
The whole like Fear and Loathing prequel thing. I think it might be The Tourist.
Yeah.
2010.
Yeah. And he works a lot. We're skipping past.
He works a lot.
Skipping through a lot of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, his last few roles.
And then it's like, and then you go, okay, so he did The Tourist, which, let's be fair, as much as we're saying like he's too over the top now, that he was underplayed and normal in that movie. That movie was horrible.
It was
so
horrible.
It's not like that
it's
was
not
like
a guarantee. It's not a guarantee that it'll be good.
But I think your point is a very good one, which is that at this point, it's not like. I'm trying to think who it would be. Like George Clooney. George Clooney plays George Clooney in most of his roles, right? He has a type, and he doesn't do a lot of accents and wigs and mustaches and things.
Right. Every once in a while, he'll like put on some weight or play a character who is not supposed to be attractive.
Exactly. And that like for him is a big stretch.
It's a big stretch, yeah.
And Johnny Depp is the complete opposite. He is never himself. He is always a character. And you almost feel like, you know, people, I think there is an appeal when an actor sort of goes outside of their comfort zone. But it feels like, and I agree with you, it seems like he's constantly pushing against that sort of sex symbol thing that he got at a young age. But it's like, can you imagine if Johnny Depp, if he still was capable of it, maybe he's not. But right now, if he made a really suave movie star movie, I feel like people would be really into it. They're ready for Johnny Depp to get rid of all this
stuff. Play it straight and not be like, yeah, I know. It's funny because there are some actors that I feel, Brad Pitt and Mark Wahlberg in particular,
mm-hmm.
are much more interesting, tend to be much more interesting in side roles.
In supporting roles, yes.
Like, they kind of vanish a lot of the times as leading men, you know? They're just, like, they're bland. And
I agree.
They come to life in these supporting roles. And I feel like Depp is trying to will himself into that in some ways, or if he is going to be a leading man, he's going to be a really weird one.
Yeah.
He's going to layer on all kinds of tics and accents and oddities. But he's what, 52 now? He's like a still very handsome guy.
He looks great for 52.
Right. It's like he doesn't ever want that to be an aspect of his character.
Which, to a certain extent, I that's sort of admirable that he doesn't want to just be a handsome guy. Like, that's, you know.
Right, but you can be a handsome guy right?
Absolutely.
Like, I don't think
he doesn't seem capable, though. He at least, you know, chooses not to.
Yeah.
It's funny all the things you say about him, you know, wanting to be sort of this weird hybrid of a leading man and a supporting character. That kind of goes perfectly with my first pick. Should I go first?
Please.
All right. Well, this is probably a movie a lot of people have seen, but I'm guessing not in a while, and one that their opinion of might have been affected by thanks to a bunch of really crappy sequels. And that is the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie, The Curse of the Black Pearl, which is now available on Netflix. And if Johnny Depp has become a caricature of himself at this point, this is where he started that sketch, right? Captain Jack Sparrow, the flamboyant pirate, searching the high seas for his beloved ship, which has been taken by Barbossa, right? And I liked this movie a lot when it came out. But I think you could argue, thinking about it again for this podcast, I think you could make the case that The First Pirates is one of the movies of this century with the biggest negative impact on Hollywood. It encouraged people to make more movies out of theme park rides and concepts and things that have, I would say, narratively dubious potential as movies. It inspired this whole franchise, specifically the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, which has given us three bad movies, I would say, two really bad sequels, and one sequel. I thought the third movie was one of the worst, like, big major blockbusters I've ever seen. I sat in the theater praying for the movie to end. I thought it was awful, the third one.
I don't know if I even remember.
At World's End?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely atrocious.
Was that the one with the whirlpool?
I believe so,
yeah,
yes.
That was
A very potent symbol for how the whole thing had just completely gone down the drain. It gave us, it really made Orlando Bloom into sort of like a leading man for a little while. That didn't work well for anybody. And it really seemed to, that was, to me, that's the tipping point for Johnny Depp. He always liked accents and hair and characters and being big and broad. But that was the movie where he really indulged all of these impulses, and it worked. And it seemed to really inspire him to go off the deep end. So I hadn't looked back at the original movie in a while. And going back to it for the first time in I don't know how many years, I really found it. It's a great little movie. It's a wonderful entertainment.
It's not little, though.
It's not little. Okay. But it's a wonderful movie. It's a really great old-fashioned Hollywood adventure movie. You know, I think it's one of the best movies of this kind outside of, like, the original Indiana Jones movies that's been made in the last couple of decades. And Johnny Depp is great in it.
And also, he's, like, doled out appropriately.
Well, that's exactly what my point was going to be, is that he is not the main character. Or if he is, the movie is big enough. Maybe it's a little too big, but he doesn't feel like the central figure. He's the supporting character. He's the comic relief. Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley are having this sort of sweet, very straight, played very straight love story, and he kind of gets to come in and be goofy and wacky and silly. And it's just the right amount. And all those sequels made, particularly like the last couple, made Captain Jack Sparrow the main character. And that was absolutely toxic to that franchise. And that's a big reason why the sequels don't work, is that we best in small portions. I think that's true of Jack Sparrow. And I think that's particularly true of this style of Johnny Depp, is that. And again, this is exactly what you were saying, and this was the point I was going to make, is that he seems to want to be a supporting actor. He wants to be a bit player, but maybe it's because of his stature, his name, his fame, his good looks, his bankability. He keeps getting cast in these leading man roles, and it just doesn't work. He doesn't play leading men. He plays these goofy sidekicks that get put in the main role, and that's really... It sucks, frankly, in a lot of cases. And the one other thing I wanted to say is that looking at the movie again, something I'd never thought of before, was that his big, broad performance in this movie, it's almost like a human being's impression of an animatronic. And of course, you know, the Pirates of the Caribbean are animatronic. There was no Jack Sparrow character, but just his herky-jerky movements, it's almost like he's doing an impression of a robot. Like a robot that's trying to pretend to be human.
I didn't see that. He rolls his eyes even the way.
Yeah, he's just like the sauntering around with these big gestures that seem strangely unmotivated. He really felt to me like an animatronic. You know, you called him a cartoon character in Mordecai, and I think that there is something very unreal about him in a lot of these movies, and it doesn't often work, but it did here. But woe that it the impact that it had on his career and all of Hollywood. But I like this first movie, the original Pirates. It's available on Netflix. It's still a good movie.
All right. Well, for my pick, I will say it was another point in his career where I feel like you saw one of the first flashes of him wanting to play these type of roles.
Yeah.
And only these type of roles. And it is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Now streaming on Amazon Prime. A movie I like a lot. 1998. He had just made Donnie Brasco the year before. Probably one of his most acclaimed, like, playing it straight performances.
Still has an accent.
But like,
it's
playing,
more subdued.
It's set in the real world.
Yes.
You know, and before then, he played a lot of quirky leading man roles like Benny and June and What's Eating Gilbert Grape and Don Juan DeMarco. These are not like gritty realism, but these are all roles in which he was basically, he was like an alt romantic hero.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of putting it.
But as like Hunter S. Thompson stand and Raoul Duke in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, there's nothing meant to be attractive about how Depp is playing this. You know, he actively blows up the image of himself as like this handsome Hollywood star. He's balding, he's twitchy, he's wearing the same like outfit of like shorts and that hat.
Fisherman's hat.
Yeah. You know, he's on at least three substances at all times in this movie. In which he plays a journalist who, with his friend and attorney, Dr. Gonzo, played by a great Benicio del Toro, goes to Vegas to ostensibly cover a motorcycle race, but actually to just do a ton of drugs and meditate on the American dream in the wake of the end of the idealistic 60s. And this is really a movie in which it's like two sidekicks in search of a leading man, you know, which is one of the things that's so pleasurable about it. In fact, Raoul Duke and Dr. Gonzo kind of take turns being the one who's like the dominant one, you know, the more sane one. There are times in which, you know, it's one of like Dr. Gonzo is telling Raoul Duke to like pull it together, or like we've got to do this. And then other times in which he's the wild and crazy one,
right,
who has to be hemmed in or run away from when he's brandishing a knife. And, you know, Gilliam's sensibility works. It melds surprisingly well with Thompson's fantasia of, like, circus on acid, of these lounges in which everyone turns into this grotesque lizard because the main characters are on hallucinogens. But I think one of the things that's, like, looking at this movie again, one of the things that is noteworthy about it is just how free Depp looks. Like, he is having a great time in this role, not just because he loves Hunter S. Thompson and was friends with Hunter S. Thompson and would go back to the well again for the Rum Diaries in 2011 with less success, but that he is playing a character who assumes that he is off on the side and doesn't, like, who isn't necessarily the center of attention because he is, like, the best looking guy or something like that. You know, he's playing this weird character who does, like, a lot of physical comedy. You know, some of the best, most enjoyable parts of this movie are the ones in which they, the two of them do ether and, like, can barely walk into circus. Their, like, legs don't work. Or when they're on the bar, the carousel bar in circus and can't get off of it because they're both so high that, like, it is physically too difficult to step off of a slowly moving platform. You know, those parts are really funny. And also, I think, not the kind of thing that you would normally associate Depp with, even if when he'd done kind of physical, I mean, in Benny and June, he's, you know, he does a lot of physical stuff, but I like to do something that's basically like druggy slapstick. He does very well. He leans into it really well. And I feel like this movie, as much as he was playing an exaggerated version of a regular character, it was, you could see those flickers of something that he would eventually go on to really just bank on in Pirates and then just, you know, lean into too much later on. But it's really enjoyable in Fear and Loathing. And I think, as with Pirates of the Caribbean, you can see ways in which, like, this brings out a good part of, like, him as an actor, just as long as it's not, it's in the right project and it's not too far. You know, like, this is a movie that I think holds up very well and is especially in the ways in which it goes, like, he is able to channel it going from we're going to go blow things up to where this movie eventually gets to, which is, like, threatening a waitress in a rundown diner with a knife. And, like, just all of the fun fizzling out of this venture. And he channels that very well. Like, he brings the movie from those heights down to those lows and makes it work. So Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, even if it was the start of modern Depp, it is still good, and it's available on Amazon Prime.
I like that we're trying to find, like, the origin, the original sin.
I mean, there's not... the problem is, or not the problem, but, like, he's done stylized things all the way back.
Yeah.
You know? It's not like there was the one thing. But I feel like when you start to get that turn from being, like... He's stylized in Crybaby.
Yeah.
You know? But he's a stylized heartthrob in Crybaby. Mm-hmm. Whereas... he's not a heartthrob in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
No, certainly not. All right, my next pick. It's funny. Without discussing this in advance, we really have this. I mean, maybe it's just very obvious, but we have this very similar conception of him now, which is that he really has become this living cartoon. And so, because of that, because I was thinking that way watching him in Mordecai and stuff, I wanted to watch him in an actual cartoon, which is why my next pick is Corpse Bride, Tim Burton and Mike Johnson's stop-motion animated movie from 2005, which is now available on Netflix. And what surprised me, having never actually seen this movie before, is how Depp is the straight man in this film, and he's playing maybe the most subdued character of this era of his career, except, again, the one we mentioned, Transcendence, where he's literally a computer, and computers tend to be pretty dry when they talk. So his character in Corpse Bride is Victor. He's the son of these rich merchants, and he's about to be married off in this arranged marriage to the daughter of another wealthy family. But while he's out practicing his vows, he accidentally proposes to a corpse, which is a thing that happens all the time to all of us, I know. The titular Corpse Bride, voiced by Helena Bonham Carter. And that creates all these tensions and confusions, and you have the sort of this very confusing love triangle between Victor, the dead wife, the living fiance, and the two worlds of the living and the dead. And that juxtaposition is what I liked best about the movie, how Burton and Johnson portray the world of the living as very, this very bland place. It's very gray. You know, it's almost a black and white movie in the world of the living. But the world of the dead is very bright. It has these wild neon colors. Kind of reminded me of Beetlejuice, actually, where the world of the afterlife is garish and kind of scary and kind of monstrous, but also sort of alive and beautiful and full of all this creative design. And yeah, Depp mostly plays it very straight, which is strange, because as we've been saying, like, when he makes live action movies, he becomes a cartoon. And yet here in a cartoon, he somehow is capable of reining himself in and almost like underplaying it. And he has this very sweet innocence that's perfect for his character here. And it's just like watching it kind of, it made me like something like Mordecai even less, because it's like, okay, so he, it's not something that's not within him. He is capable. These are deliberate choices he's making. I just don't know why he can't do it. And as I enjoyed this movie, but it befuddled me, and it made me question even more, you know, a movie like Mordecai, like a Black Mass, you know, even something like the Alice movies, where again, like there, he's like almost like adapting a cartoon in a sense, you know, by like it's a live action version of a cartoon.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, yeah, you know, like or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, like those characters are barely human,
yeah,
they're just like they're so out there,
right? And yeah. Yet here in this, it's like, I don't know. I would say, well, he needs to be in a story like this where everything is so outrageous, but he can be the grounded center. But that's kind of Mordecai, or it could have been. They chose not to make it that way. So I'm going to throw up my hands and say, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny because Corpse Bride, it feels like a continuation of this character that he has played like pretty well throughout his career, of the kind of like goth prince type character, right? Like Edward Scissorhands. And Sleepy Hollow,
yeah,
and Sweeney Todd, all of these Tim Burton movies,
yeah,
you know, like it's even if it's a type, it's one that he's done very well,
right?
And that
maybe even From Hell, there was like a whole,
yeah,
he kind of had like a mini period there, yeah,
yeah.
Where in that early 2000s where he kept going back to it,
yeah,
but then he sort of got tired of it, I guess.
He did. Well, I wanted to call out for my second pick a movie in which he is not by any means the star,
good,
but in which he plays two characters, and fascinatingly, it is Before Night Falls, which is available for rent. It's Julian Schnabel's 2000 biopic, stars Javier Bardem, who got an Oscar nomination for his role as Cuban poet Reynaldo Arenas. But Depp basically cameos twice in two scenes that are almost back-to-back, and it seems like the before and after of Johnny Depp. In the first time you see Depp, he plays Bon Bon, who is like either transgender or cross-dressing heartthrob of the prison that Reynaldo has been put into. And you see the character walking onto the yard from behind and in a dress, like this very high-cut dress, and blonde wig, lipstick. And the camera like follows this person all the way through and like focuses on Bon Bon's behind, as voiceover tells us that this person is famous for smuggling things in and out of the prison, in, let's say, the prison wallet, the prison purse, if you will. And then, you know, it's not until Depp turns around that it's like a reveal. You're like, oh, that's Johnny Depp, like in a kind of like DIY prison ball gown, lipstick, and for whatever reason, like the faintest growth of beard, and he's like he is exaggerated only as a character like that would be, you know, someone who is playing like stylized femininity, and it's like it's a really short scene, or basically he's smuggling pages out of the prison, and like you see him like removing them and passing them along to someone else to smuggle them out, and then right afterwards Depp is in the movie again as a totally different character, as a lieutenant who is just like this prison warden, this like sadistic prison warden who is trying to break the main character down and is trying to make him deny his homosexuality, inform on his friends, and admit his wrongs. And Depp is like has actually a normal looking mustache, not a Mordecai style mustache, and is and it's
noted.
Just like it's just like handsome, like as Reynaldo admits himself in voiceover, is like this really handsome, extremely like mean looking guy, and it becomes this like moment of fantasy in which he imagines like confessing all of these things and then getting embraced by this guy who says like, this is how a man behaves. And in two scenes back to back, you have Johnny Depp playing, you know, this like deliberately outsized character, and then playing this like super traditionally masculine, you know, like stereotype of authority. And the ways in which he sags from one to the other so that you almost don't recognize it at first, I think goes to show his range, you know, like it's the choice to have him be not just, oh, like a novelty cameo, you know, but to have him play these roles twice, I think just speaks to one, like this kind of like gender, like the ways in which gender is this, you know, spectrum in which someone can move, but also speaks to just his ability to, you know, transform from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. I think that it's a weird and memorable use of the person who was like the most famous face in this movie at the time in these like very small scenes. And I think when you see it, it's like hard to forget, even if it is essentially a cameo. So that is Before Night Falls, and you can rent it on all of the usual spots.
Let's do a brief discussion of a couple of movies that are in theaters, one of which I have not seen yet, and it's 10 Cloverfield Lane, and I don't want to know anything about it. So Allison's going to talk about it in the least spoilery way possible, because I'm sure you don't want to know, but I also don't want to know anything beyond what's in the trailers. I've seen the trailers, so I know Jeffrey Wells really liked it. I know that much. But other than that, what can you tell us?
It's a fun...
Don't spoil it!
...little movie. I think that it's...
Go ahead.
It's funny that it's being marketed as this spiritual sequel, whatever they're calling it.
Right.
Given they're like, oh, it's a Cloverfield movie, but also it doesn't exist in the same timeline or universe or whatever J.J. Abrams is saying at any one time. I mean, the main question of the movie is basically... how this will or will not line up with the idea of being a Cloverfield type movie.
I see.
But it's mostly a kind of three person thriller,
mm-hmm.
you know, mostly set in this bunker with John Goodman, a great John Goodman. He's and Mary Elizabeth Winstead and John Gallagher Jr. as the three in it. And basically Mary Elizabeth Winstead is trying to figure out if John Goodman is pulling a Kimmy Schmidt on her. Or not, and whether whether it's true that bad things have happened up above, or whether he's crazy, which is not necessarily the same thing. He might be crazy and bad things have happened up above, one or the other. But and also whether like John Gallagher Jr. can be trusted. It's nicely directed, and I think that's what makes it work so well, is that it uses this very claustrophobic space, and it doles out bits of information really in a great way, but it also trusts the performers, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character is one of those rare characters in a movie like this who doesn't make really dumb every choice she makes is smart given mm-hmm. the bad situation,
mm-hmm.
and there's something very refreshing about being able to see that, where you're never like, no, what
right.
are you doing? What, you know, like, it's a movie that...
There's no stinky cheese joke. It all makes
exactly,
sense.
Exactly. It all makes sense. And so, and I think there's something that's just, like, such a relief about that when mm-hmm. you're not mad at the characters doing things because the plot requires it.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a nicely done little movie. And when you see it, I'm interested in talking about the second half of it with you.
Okay.
But
well, hopefully I'll get to see it soon.
Yeah.
I'm sure
I
will, because I got nothing else going on, and I have lots of free time to watch movies.
Of course.
So the other film we wanted to talk about very briefly is The Brothers Grimsby, also now playing in theaters. It's the new Sacha Baron Cohen movie. He has sort of, I guess, I think been forced to abandon the whole, you know, kind of prank mode of filmmaking where he, you know, pretends to be someone, goes out in the real world and makes a fake documentary because I think he's a little too famous and too recognizable now. So this is a straight fiction film. He plays this sort of dopey, drunken soccer hooligan character who's been was separated as a child from his brother, who's now played by Mark Strong, who is also now a secret agent, and they're reunited and get sort of accidentally on the run. You know, it's like a buddy spy cop road movie with lots of vulgar humor. Did you like this one?
I thought it was fine. I mean, I thought like the one of the jokes in particular set up was hilarious, and like
the elephants.
Yes, the elephants. Yeah. I liked the slightly underdeveloped idea of it as like a way of digging into James Bond's class issues, because I mean, Mark Strong is basically playing a James Bond type character.
He's James Bond.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that, and then to have his brother and his past be like the most like
working class,
like the most like nightmare
self-described
kind of, like,
scum,
right? Like the Daily Mail's most like condescending version of like a working class life,
right?
And to have that be like his origins, and to have this character like be following him around, who is always carrying a drink,
right?
Like, has a drink.
This reminder of where he came from,
right? I think like is a. I mean, I enjoyed that.
It's a great idea that the movie barely explores.
I know. It's, I mean, the movie is like 80 minutes long.
Yeah.
And like, it mostly just goes from like big
joke to joke
set piece. Yeah.
Yeah. You talked about, I forget when earlier in this podcast, with Mordecai, where it doesn't feel like that movie was cut to shreds to make something poppy and fun and mainstream accessible. This feels like that. It feels like there was a 2-hour version of this movie that really burrowed into the characters, that got into the psychology of the Mark Strong character and also the Sacha Baron Cohen character. And that at some point, either the studio or Sacha Baron Cohen or whoever was like, nope, just make the funny version of this. And that's what it is. Like, how the two brothers are reunited makes no sense.
Nope.
They don't explain it at all. It's just like, he's literally like the world's greatest secret agent, and Sacha Baron Cohen's friend at a bar, who's another drunken soccer fan, is like, your brother's going to be over here. And it's like, how could you possibly know that? He's James Bond. How could you find James Bond that way? But whatever. It's not really about that. And I think there's some jokes in here that are very offensive. Like, knowingly, they're trying to push buttons. It's sort of Sacha Baron Cohen's way is to be a provocateur.
Sure. There are multiple AIDS jokes.
Yes. And I felt very ashamed of myself, but I laughed very hard at this movie several times. Enough to say that, like, I would say as a comedy, it's worth seeing. All right, let's get to Behind the Eight Ball, where we run down some new releases, some listener recommendations, and one film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists. Allison, who's going first this time?
I want to go first.
You do?
Yes.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay. Well, why don't you start with three new releases?
Okay. First up, new to Netflix, is season 2 of Halt and Catch Fire, the AMC series about the 80s PC revolution in Texas. This is one of those series that I started watching the first season, was very underwhelmed by it. Like, Lee Pace played this character that really felt like a Don Draper knockoff. Went back to it. The season went in directions I hadn't expected. I was on board. The second season changed the focus to the wives of the two main characters as they start what is basically like an early version of a networked gaming company, like in the modem era, like little tanks fighting each other, and becomes just like so fascinating and like so unexpected. Its storyline goes in no directions that you can kind of predict. And it's just about a type of company that like I've never seen before. And it really like shifts the focus to Mackenzie Davis and Carrie Bechet, who are both like great, like Lee Pace and Scoot McNairy are excellent actors, but they were kind of running through a lot of rhythms that I'd seen before in a lot of prestige dramas. And in shifting that focus, I just felt like a new show. So I really recommend it. I would even say like you might even be able to just start in season 2 and you can pick up a lot of where the dramas were and then work your way back to season 1 if you want. But that's worth checking out. That's on Netflix now. Also new to Netflix, Jafar Panahi's Taxi, one of my favorite movies of last year. You know, Panahi has been officially banned from making movies by the Iranian government, has made 3 movies since then, and this is one of them. And like those other two, it's this kind of mix of documentary and fiction in which he is driving a taxi around Tehran and picks up different people who sometimes seem like characters out of his movie and are sometimes supposed to be people he knows. And as it goes on, it becomes this conversation about his films, about censorship, about the reality of making movies in Iran. and about just all of these stories bubbling up just everywhere he looks. It's a really wonderful movie, and I'm glad that it's on Netflix now and more people can check it out. That is Taxi. And finally, new to Fandor is River of Grass. This is Kelly Reichardt's directorial debut. She made this movie in 1994, I believe, and then didn't make movies for years until Old Joy. And this one stars Lisa Bowman as Cozy, who is a housewife who meets a man named Lee, who's played by Larry Fessenden, filmmaker and actor, at a bar. And they go on the run together after they think they might have accidentally committed a murder. And it's supposed to be, I haven't seen it yet, it's on my, I'm looking forward to watching it, but it is supposed to be very different from her other movies, which are these very intimate, meditative studies, character studies, and but it's supposed to be very good. So I'm looking forward to checking that out. That is River of Grass, and it is on Fandor.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Okay, first up we have one from Pat, who writes, "My partner and I have just finished watching the Netflix original series River, and I want to recommend it to you. River is a police detective in London whose perception is off, let's say. When we meet him, we see that he is distracted, pale, and seemingly depressed. After the disastrous pursuit of a suspect, we learn what is ailing him, and it makes for absolutely gripping storytelling. The writing for this show is gorgeous. The dialogue is perfect at every turn. The photography is also beautiful, showing off London, a beautiful city, through stunning shots of its architecture, as well as moody moments in a series of dismal interiors whose flickering fluorescent lights add to the viewer's unease, not to mention the detective's rapidly deteriorating mind. Also, River made me weep. It was pretty heartrending. Please put it on your my lists if you haven't already." So thank you for that, Pat. I have actually seen River. I enjoyed it a lot as well and would second that recommendation. It's a British series, but Netflix picked it up as an original in the US. And it's Stellan Skarsgård, who is always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a second recommendation from Crystal. Actually, this is a double recommendation. First up, Crystal writes, "The Apple. How does one describe this 1980 musical? It is set in the future, which is, of course, 1994.
Mm-hmm.
There are dancers, an Adam and Eve allegory, and actual vampires.
Yep.
It is one of those. It is so bad that it is good movies ever." And that is streaming on Amazon Prime. And then Crystal writes, "I was spurred to rewatch it by Electric Boogaloo, the wild untold story of Canon Films. It is a fascinating tale of two Israeli cousins who look to make their way in Hollywood by producing some of the best schlock ever made. Arm wrestling competition over the top, anyone?" And that is streaming on Netflix. And those are two great recommendations. Thank you, Crystal.
Okay, and one film chosen blindly by number from your my list.
You gave me number 20, which is A Royal Affair. Now we've just had the year of Alicia Vikander. This was the movie I think she first got attention for in the U.S. before this, in which she plays Princess Caroline, who is betrothed in the 1700s to the Mad King of Denmark, and then falls in love with this German doctor who is this idealistic figure played by Mads Mikkelsen, and obviously having a secret affair as a royal never works out well. But it's supposed to be lush and beautiful, and those are two actors I like a lot. So it's on my list. All right, Matt, are you ready?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Three new releases.
All right. First up, my most anticipated show of the spring. It's Bosch Season 2 on Amazon Prime. Titus Welliver returns as L.A. cop Harry Bosch, the creation of crime novelist Michael Connelly. And that's what I liked best about the first season of Bosch. It actually felt like a crime novel in televised form. It told this big case over the course of the season, but it wasn't sprawling. It didn't concern itself too much with big, huge themes. It was just a mystery thriller. And I plowed through the first season like a hot knife through butter. I have, you know, very little time to watch things with the job, the baby, everything else going on. But my number one priority above all of that right now is to find some time to watch season two of Bosch on Amazon Prime. Next up, you know who else made a great cop, Allison?
Who?
Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's who. And in Eraser, Schwarzenegger plays U.S. Marshal John Kruger, who erases witnesses who are in danger. And in this movie, he has to protect Vanessa Williams from a bunch of bad guys. It's not one of Schwarzenegger's best.
It is not.
Because they're all his best, Allison. Every single one, a masterpiece. Eraser is now available on Netflix. finally, let's close out this trifecta of crime recommendations with Victoria, which is also new on Netflix. This movie from 2015 has a unique technical style. The entire movie unfolds in one long take. It's not a fake out. There's no tricks. Takes aren't sewn together to look like one long take, like Birdman, for example. Director Sebastian Shipper shot the movie, we know the date, April 27, 2014, from 4:30 to 7 a.m. in Berlin. It follows a Spanish girl named Victoria, played by Laia Costa, in one of my favorite performances of 2015. She's out dancing at a late-night club, she meets a few guys, and eventually winds up getting dragged into a bank heist. I feel like some of the characters' decisions, maybe they don't make the most sense. The 10 Cloverfield Lane thing where you're sitting there going, I don't know if I would do this. I don't know if this makes sense. I feel like maybe it doesn't pass that test with flying colors, let's say. But I thought this movie was both an impressive achievement and a pretty good crime story and a love story to boot. So that is Victoria, available on Netflix.
All right, two listener recommendations.
Our first comes from David in Los Angeles. He says, my recommendation is the Japanese anime series Attack on Titan on Netflix. It depicts a dystopian future in which the scant remainder of humanity live in a single city behind three massive walls erected to protect them from man-eating giants called Titans that seemingly roam the rest of the planet. The series begins when a new type of Titan, capable of breaking through the city's walls, materializes, and suddenly the years of peace humanity has enjoyed evaporates. The show combines the deep mystery of the early seasons of Lost, the unexpected deaths of major characters like Game of Thrones, and what's basically the best Incredible Hulk story ever committed to the screen. The wall-to-wall action is gorgeously rendered as humanity's elite hunters known as Scouts fly around using their portable zipline systems and do their best to slice these massive and frankly terrifying Titans to death. I hesitate to give away any more details lest I spoil the story, but suffice to say, anyone who starts watching the show will find it hard to stop. So that's Attack on Titan on Netflix. And we've also got a recommendation from James. And we should note that James is one of the filmmakers involved in the film he's recommending, but we don't necessarily have a problem with that as long as we acknowledge that. James says, I don't know if you know about the site NoBudge, NoBudge.com, NoBudge.com, but it has a lot of no-budget movies put up by filmmakers. I would love for you to check out our movie, New Cops. So you can find that at NoBudge.com/main/new-cops. And that is a site we are familiar with. It's a site where filmmakers can put up their movies and you can watch them for free. And this is like a 52-minute sort of between a short and a feature. And so I think, No Budge is a really cool site. If you're into really little indie movies.
It's run by a filmmaker, Tucker Audley.
And, you know, if you're looking to sort of discover filmmakers at the beginnings of their career, it's often a place where you can find some really interesting people doing smart, unusual stuff. So the website is NoBudge.com, and the movie is New Cops. The plot description I will read to you. An ordinary man lives a dull life till his friend Chet comes over to stay for a few days. ... What could be in that ellipsis, Allison, I wonder?
I'm intrigued.
All right.
All right, and one from my list.
You gave me number 14, which is Major League, the comedy Major League. I love how Netflix describes this movie. A baseball team built to lose does just that in all sorts of wacky ways. Can these outcast athletes rally in the ninth? I wonder. I added a bunch of like comedies that I like to my high list when my daughter was born, just to have stuff to watch like at 4 a.m. when I was feeding her and stuff. And this was one of the movies that I added, which I've seen many times. Major League. It's a good movie. Allison, we have another very interesting trio of choices for our listeners' choice options.
All comedies this time.
Yes, it's a comedy showcase. I believe I have the first one.
You do.
I venture to say this will probably be the favorite.
I think so.
Yeah, probably. It is Pee-wee's Big Holiday, the new original Pee-wee movie, the first movie in quite a long while from Pee-wee, from Paul Reubens. It's directed by John Lee. And it will be available on Netflix starting on March 18th. The plot description, a fateful meeting with a mysterious stranger, inspires Pee-wee Herman to take his first ever holiday in this epic story of friendship and destiny. I believe we've both seen this movie already.
We have. We haven't talked about it, though.
We have no idea.
We're refusing to talk about it.
Yeah, we have no idea what each other thinks about it. I would say that plot description sums it up pretty well. I think it's fair to say the mysterious stranger is played by Joe Manganiello.
Yes. I should point out that I'm sure this happened to you as well.
Yes.
We were handed a sheet of a letter from Pee-wee, the desk
allegedly from the desk of Pee-wee Herman,
suggesting that we not give away two details that basically make it impossible to describe the plot of the movie any more than that.
Correct. It's one of the most ludicrous things I've ever been given press screening.
It feels like trolling almost to be like, can you write about this movie?
It's a dare. It's like a dare. It's like, can you talk about this movie without describing the most fundamental thing it's about?
Yes.
Well, we're not going to try right now.
Nope. Absolutely
so
not.
If maybe after the movie is available, it'll be okay to discuss it.
I think so.
Yeah. So that's Pee-wee's Big Holiday, and that is going to be available on Netflix on March 18th.
All right, our second pick is a movie that came out, I believe, last year. Got a very small release. It is a movie called Balls Out, and it is available for streaming on Hulu. A sports comedy directed by Andrew Disney, starring Jake Lacy, everyone's favorite new boyfriend, and Kate McKinnon of SNL, and Lady Ghostbusters, and among others, and is about a group of college students that form an intramural football team in their senior year. This movie was originally titled Intramural and then was given the much worse title Balls Out and like marketed with a poster of a girl's underwear clad behind. And I feel like from everything I've read about this movie, which has gotten like pretty solidly good reviews, that is not representative of the type of comedy it aims to be. So for good things about this, it definitely came and went very quickly. Kate McKinnon on her way to being a giant star. Mm. And Jake Lacy has also been kind of really coming up through the ranks and has been charming as hell as this kind of dorky boyfriend in
yes.
multiple romantic comedies. So yeah, that's one I'd like to check out.
It's a very intriguing pair.
It is.
I like both of those people a lot.
A lot, yeah. So that is Balls Out, and it is on Hulu.
Okay. Option 3 is currently available to rent on Amazon and iTunes. It's Me, Him, and Her. This is the directorial debut of Max Landis, the writer of a bunch of movies, including Chronicle, American Ultra. What else am I missing? Victor Frankenstein, right? He wrote that as well, the recent Frankenstein movie. This is his first effort as a director, I believe, and the plot description is... 20-something drifter Corey arrives in Los Angeles to help his semi-famous TV star friend Brendan take his first steps out of the closet. The movie has a good cast. Aaliyah Shawkat, Gina Davis, Luke Bracey, Lance Hendrickson, Casey Wilson, and Haley Joel Osment. I haven't read a ton about this movie. It's gotten sort of very kind of small, quiet release.
It had its world premiere at like the Seattle Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think, yeah. I know there's like a talking penis in it or something.
Oh.
I saw like the image that they were sending around promotionally for it had like a life-size member bending over someone to talk to them.
Interesting. Interesting.
Who knows?
Well, I don't know what to say to that except to say that this is option number 3, Me, Him, Her, available for rent on Amazon and iTunes.
All right. Well, which of these comedies should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You tell us. You can either send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or, and this is much easier, you can just enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, March 21st at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that week to watch the film. And then join us for our conversation on the next episode, which will come out on or around Tuesday, March 29th.
FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Filmspotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick. But in the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore, at Matt Singer, and follow the show at FilmspottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from you guys, the SVU listeners. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on iTunes. Always helpful in helping us reach new listeners. And you want us to reach new listeners, right?
Right. Matt can't do all these accents just in a vacuum of existing listeners.
Yes, I say. Leave us a message.
All
leave
right.
us a genius.
All right, let's wrap it up.
For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.